Brown and I asked Tina and all I did is the brown. I know what you talk.
Good morning, everybody. This is the Select Committee on Human Services, part of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. This is June 11th, 2015. And it's 8:35, so we're 5 minutes late already. It may be a new record for getting behind, but hopefully it isn't. We're going to start by opening up a work session on the House Bill 3100. Lindy, would you lead it through it? And we're going to invite Representative Greenick to come up first.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 3100 restructures the framework for conducting public health activities and duties in the state and for how public health services are provided to Oregonians. This bill really came out of a task force that Representative Greenlick worked very hard on during the interim. The proposed budget for public health that we're going to actually hear today includes a one-time $500,000 general fund package in order to cover the planning and assessment activities that are expected during the 15-17 biennium.
Thank you. Do we have to have a motion or can we just take testimony right now? Let's just take testimony. Good morning, Representative. Can you introduce yourself to the committee and for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, which is Northwest Portland out into Washington County. I'm very pleased that you brought this bill up and that I have a chance to briefly introduce it. In 2013, we had House Bill 2348, which started out with a proposed solution to how to deal with public health. And cooler heads prevailed and said, well, let's maybe not start with a solution. Let's start by looking at the problem and seeing if we can figure out what to do. The problem is very clear. The public health system, the governmental public health system in the state is not entirely ready to deal with the kind of public health threats that we may be facing in the future. For example, Representative Boone is very much involved in the question of what happens if we have a serious earthquake, tsunami problem on the coast. The coast would be literally cut off from the rest of the state. And if that happened right now, the public health system in the coast would not be prepared to deal with what would follow from that. So this put in place a commission that worked very hard to produce an extraordinary report. Report's on the website, if OHA's website, if you want to look at it. But it's an extraordinary report that says that creates the understanding of what foundational public health services are required for every citizen of the state to have available. And it put forth a blueprint for how to move to that kind of a model public health system, a modern public health system, over the next decade. That's not going to be something that's going to start, be finished in one biennium. This is a long-term project. What House Bill 3100 does is it establishes what the foundational elements of a modern public health system would be like and sets in place a process by which the state and the counties working together can create the model for the future. And this, the counties are the local public health authorities in this state. They need to be a part of the game, and the process would be to create a model that puts modern public health in one of three models, county by county. First model is a county could take over the whole system and put in place a modern public health system with all the foundational elements, some of which they would be providing themselves and some of which they would be providing in partnerships with other components of the health system. A second model would be counties could regionalize, could join with other counties, such as we have one regional public health system now in Sherman and Wasco and one other county nearby. I don't remember what the third one is. It could regionalize, or the third model could be a county could provide itself some of the elements, some of the foundational elements of a public health system, but could join with other counties to do some other components in a joint way. The 3100 gives OHA the responsibility over the next biennium to work with each and every county in the state to create a timetable and a model that that puts together a clear-cut understanding of what resources would be needed to move us from where we are to where we need to be in a way that makes sense from the state perspective as well as from the county perspective, and calls for a collaborative model for working in that direction. So you'll have some other folks talking about this as well, but I think this is an extraordinarily important bill. It's certainly the number one priority of the House Health Care Committee. When I was asked to prioritize bills, this became the only one in the first tier, and everything else is second and third tier. So I think we really need this for the future. And that's all I have to say to introduce. I'd be happy to ask any questions you might have.
Well, first off, I'm going to thank you for your hard work. I didn't know this was your first priority. If I had, we'd be holding the bill.
I'm sorry I let that slip out. Yeah.
You should know better by now, Representative.
President Courtney, you may have heard that already, and this bill is now in trouble. Okay. Questions?
I'm very excited about this.
Yeah, I really do appreciate what you brought forward, Representative. Like, this is really time to do it with the expansion of the ACA and getting public health back to being public health, not a repository for where we do the things that we can't get done elsewhere in individual care. Moving away from individual care and back to public health is really important. I also think it's important because we're seeing a hodgepodge around the state of different types of public health. In Josephine County, the CCO down there supporting it, or they wouldn't have a public health. And our county's a little better. Multnomah's completely different. And I think what you're bringing forward is absolutely necessary. And I like the thoughtful way you're going about it, too.
Well, we had the transformation of the personal health care system, modernization of public health, and that will leave us free to work on mental health.
Yes.
We all know it's the next major problem we have to deal with.
I hope that's your priority next time.
It is indeed.
I'll work with you on that. Representative Olson.
Thank you. Representative G, thanks for bringing this to us. Since you mentioned initially at the very beginning of your testimony about Representative Boone's area and the potential of a tsunami. What? Okay.
Go ahead.
I just got my cue. I have to stop.
No. You go ahead.
I'm curious, how do you plug in or have you considered Oregon Emergency Management and the 911 system for your PSAPs throughout the state, too, for connection with this?
Well, I was really surprised when the resiliency report came out. It was a kind of remarkable report, but it didn't mention public health at all. And it's needed. And I met with some of the commission director and things like that. It seems to me we need to, public health needs to be a really important part of that. As has been pointed out to us, you imagine the coast in that kind of situation without a single road that will connect to the valley. You have to figure out, you have to have resources available there in a way that makes sense on their own right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only that, I mean, it's, we saw a moderate Ebola scare, which had a few cases and sort of had to mobilize everybody in the state. Even here, the state was working with the county health to say, what do we do if we have an Ebola attack? We have a flu pandemic. We have a variety of things that are coming in. Now, the report makes very clear, governmental public health will not be able to do this all by themselves. I think governmental public health needs to be mobilized, but there needs to be partnership with a variety of elements in order to create that system, with schools, with CCOs have to be a very important part of this. Other partners that are very clearly a part of it. So, yeah, I mean, it seems to me making sure there is a link between governmental public health and the 911 system and other disaster planning. A disaster planning is one of the foundational elements of the public health system we're talking about in this report.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Rep. Greenlink, for doing this. And to answer your question, you're absolutely right. The original Oregon Resilience Plan did not have a very fleshed out plan for public health addressing these issues. And so We now have this session, Senate Bill 808, which is sort of the Oregon Resilience Plan Part 2 for the people issues of mass casualties, mass displacement, et cetera, which will incorporate, it will be another task force to make these recommendations. And hopefully you would want to be considered for a post on that.
I'd very much be interested.
That would be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to emphasize further what Representative Greenlee said, you know, if you think about something like the earthquake that hit Haiti about 10 years ago now almost, you know, one of the things, a lot of people unfortunately died in that because of their poor architecture system, but a significant number of people have died subsequently because of public health issues. And if you think cholera is a developing nation's problem, you'd be surprised, and it would be a problem here after an earthquake with a tsunami. And if we did not have an adequate public health system in place with the kinds of interconnectivity that Representative Greenlee mentioned, we would lose probably more lives to avoidable disease than we would to the earthquake and tsunami, I believe. I really do. And it's one of the many reasons that this absolutely needs to be part of our resiliency planning, and we need to totally modernize our public health system. So I'm particularly grateful to Representative Greenlee for bringing this up and the work he's done on it.
I see South Korea this morning, Mr. Chair. Their economy is being affected by the MERS epidemic that's going on there. I mean, they're changing the interest rate in their economy because the isolation around that disease is affecting the national economy.
Right.
Closing factories.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, would you entertain a motion?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3100 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
As it has been moved that we move House Bill 3100 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so passed. Congratulations.
Thank you. And we'll see if I can get another bill next door.
Mr. Chair, if nobody else is eager to do this, I'd be honored to carry this
second
tier
bill.
Second tier bill.
Yeah.
In full?
No. That's okay. Is anybody in the House want to carry it?
Yes. Okay.
Okay, I thought so.
Cool.
I'd like to carry it in the House floor.
Yes.
We can make it happen, I believe. Okay. And Representative Steiner Hayward, I think, would like to carry it on the
I'll touch base with Senator Mona Sanderson since she co-chaired the committee. So if she wants to, I'd be more than happy to.
Did she co-chair the committee for this?
Yeah, so I'll check with her.
She really should do it then.
She should probably do it.
Check with her.
Okay. I'll check with her.
I don't know what they're doing.
We can adjust later if need be.
Thank you. So I will open a work session now on Senate Bill 5526, the Oregon Health Authority, and we're going to go with public health first. Linda.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, again, in OLIS, you'll see the work session papers for 5526, which is the budget for public health. And then you'll also see Senate Bill 5527, which is the fee ratification bill related to some public health programs. And you'll see the budget packages in the budget that are related to the fee ratification bill. It will all become evident. So I'll start out with the memo. The public health budget is 14.5% higher than the 13-15 budget in total funds, primarily a result of that transfer of the Care Assist program from the medical assistance programs that we talked about yesterday. The general fund budget is slightly less than the current biennium for two reasons, partially because there are some lower program costs as a result of more Oregonians having insurance, and partly because of the use of excess medical marijuana revenues in lieu of general fund. So I'll go through some of the highlights here. There, as we just discussed, there's $500,000 general fund related to the 1517 activities for House Bill 3100. There's an investment of $1 million GF for additional emergency preparedness and response. It continues the investment of the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement revenues in tobacco prevention and cessation at $4.12 million. Again, we saw that yesterday coming out of the health plan and back over to public health. It includes full funding for C-Care, which is family planning, and the breast and cervical cancer screening program at current caseloads. These caseloads are down significantly as a result of the ACA expansion. It includes some additional resources for the Patient Safety Commission to allow more education and outreach to the general public as well as the provider community. It includes medical marijuana excess ending balance revenues of $5 million that are used to fund other programs in public health instead of general fund. And it increases fees in the areas of radiation protection, drinking water services, vital records, lead-based paint, and newborn screening in order to allow these programs to be maintained at current levels. And again, if we go to the worksheet, and go through some of the specific lines in a little bit more detail. So again, we're making adjustments from the current service level. So line three, package 70, revenue shortfalls. When agencies build their budgets, when they build their current service levels, they are instructed if they have a revenue shortfall, in this case, they didn't have enough fees to continue all their current programs, they're instructed to actually build in a package to show what they would reduce if they did not get the revenue increases that they're asking for. So you see reductions in other funds limitation and a reduction of six positions. And later on, as we get to lines 12 and 13, which are the packages to increase fees, you'll see those six positions are restored. Line 4 and 5, again, these are the roll-ups from e-board actions taken in September and December. So actions were taken then that impacted the 15-17 biennium as well. In the September e-board, it was an action to add some staff for the medical marijuana dispensaries program. And in December, it was related to limitation for some federal grants as well as the WIC program. Then the package 90 adjustments are all adjustments that were included in the governor's budget originally. In one case, I've made some adjustment to the amount. So on line 8, you see C-Care budget true up. In the governor's budget, $2.8 million of general fund was removed with the understanding that the program would still be whole, and we'll see some adjustments to this later, but that the program level fully funds the caseload and leaves $4.5 million of state revenue still in that program. Line 9 is the House Bill 3100 that we just talked about, the $500,000 to support that work. Line 10 is the Patient Safety Commission. In the 2013 session, some funding was provided to the Patient Safety Commission to run the early discussion and resolution portion of their program. And so they got that up and running during this last biennium. They had asked for an additional $500,000 to support some additional education and outreach activities as they have developed the program. That's been one of the needs that they saw. This reduces it down to $300,000 because they did have some carry forward revenue that they didn't spend yet. That puts their total budget for the 15-17 biennium at $1.95 million. Line 11 is emergency preparedness and response, the $1 million investment in that area in public health. Then on package 12, line 12, package 407, the radiation protection fee and cap increases. This is the budget piece associated with Senate Bill 228 that we passed out of here a couple weeks ago. So Senate Bill 228 includes the statutory changes necessary, so set some fees, sets a couple of fee caps. This is the related budget piece, which we talked about, but this is where the budget piece actually happens. So adds, $593,000 of other funds. And remember, that related to fees on tanning beds, X-ray registration, and radioactive materials licensing. Package 408 is also fees. That is specifically the fees related to the fees that were increased administratively during the interim. Again, Senate Bill 5527 that we'll hear after this actually does the ratification so that the fees continue, but Package 408 is the budget component of that. It has two fees were raised during the interim, so it has two parts. Radioactive materials licensing within the Radiation Protection Program. Those fees increased 25%. They were last increased in 2010. And that piece of the increase increases revenues about $344,000 for the biennium. The second piece is the public health lab increased the newborn screening test kit fee. This covers the cost of adding a test to the screening for severe combined immunodeficiency, commonly known as SCID, to the screening panel. It will increase, for instance, the two specimen kit, which is what's usually used for newborns, from $54 to $64. And that raises just over $1 million of revenue. Newborn screening rates generally were last increased in 2002. Line 14, Package 501, Measure 91 implementation, adds some fees for lab accreditation for the labs that will be testing marijuana and marijuana products, and adds to staff as well. Obviously, there may be more to come on funding the whole medical marijuana, recreational marijuana. It's still not completely clear exactly what all the OHA role will be, but this will be taken into account whenever we set any additional budget for related to other bills that may pass. And then new adjustments at the legislative level. Number 18, there $5 million of excess medical marijuana revenue is available in the 13-15 ending balance. It still leaves an adequate cushion of at least $2 million, and that will be used to replace general fund. Go ahead.
Is that for the medical marijuana program, $5 million, where's it coming from?
Yeah.
Just to be clear,
It's
with the expansion of the ACA, we've seen more people signing up for medical marijuana, right?
Right.
And that's where the money comes from.
Right. And while we don't expect that revenue source to go away or even decline necessarily, with everything going on in the system, there are some uncertainties. The expectation is that this is not one-time revenue and for budget bill should be treated as ongoing programs. I know programs get very nervous when they get money that there may be some indication is not going to be there next time, and then we'll have their budget cuts. And that is not the intention of using this revenue.
I think it'll go down.
Line 19 and 20 really go together. I couldn't really think of a good way to make it clear on a spreadsheet, but C-CARE's budget with the $2.8 million that the governor took out of their budget is adequately funded, but it does rely on using some carryover medical marijuana revenue that they have in the current biennium. They were uncomfortable with that, again, with that notion that it might be considered one time and they would not have adequate funding in the following biennium. And this proposal restores $1.5 million GF to that program, but then removes the $1.5 medical marijuana revenue out of the program and uses it elsewhere in place of general fund. So it's budget neutral, but it does address the C-Care and Planned Parenthood concerns.
Okay.
Line 21, the breast and cervical cancer screening program. This is, again, a budget true-up based on lower caseloads. It takes $700,000 out of the program, general fund. This does fully fund the program at almost $5 million total funds. Both they will still have a small amount of general fund. They get a lot of federal funds, and there is some Komen Foundation grants. It will continue to fund them at 275 clients per month, which is actually a little higher than they have been running the last 10 or 11 months. And with both of these programs, C-Care and breast and cervical cancer screening, the intention is to treat this program like any other caseload program. While they're not mandated caseload like the health plan, the expectation is if they have higher caseload, they should come back in a rebalance and ask for the resources to continue at that higher level. On line 22, replaces the TMSA money for the tobacco prevention and cessation, the 4.1 $2 million.
Can I ask a question here? So in 7 you remove it, and in 22 you replace it. And I'm just, is it because Package 90 was the original?
Exactly.
And the other one is the newer.
Package 90 is what was included in the governor's budget.
I see. Okay.
And I wanted both of them to show on the sheet so it was very clear to people that it was back in the budget.
Okay.
If you just net them out, nobody can see. And,
right.
And I know there was a lot of concern about that one.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Line 23 are other fee increases in the budget, including water, vital records, and lead paint. In all cases, this is to maintain current program. And the agency did come in and talk about all these earlier, too. Adds about $3.1 million other funds. And I wanted to go through just a little bit of detail on those. There's a lot of fees to keep in your head in this budget. And I know people always want to understand what they do. Drinking water services has three separate parts. They certify backflow prevention device testers and specialists. They review drinking water construction plans. They inspect drinking water systems, and they certify water system operators. And each of these have their own set of fees. Overall, the fee increase for water is more than double, and will generate about $1.26 million. This program has some specific issues besides just cost increases. Now, some of these various fees have increased, one of them in 1994, two of them in 2006, and in 2008. So it's been a while. But the other thing is that the fees had been able to be avoided up till now because we had some carry forward federal funds that were available from past projects in that program and that could legitimately be used to support some of the fee supported work. Recently, however, federal funds have remained flat, so they don't have as much, and they have now received notification from EPA that any remaining carry forward dollars will now need to be moved to the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund effective September. So the use of those federal dollars is going to end, and that is really what is driving the large fee increase in that program. Vital records, it increases the fee for birth certificates. The basic fee will go from $20 to $25. That generates $1.7 million. That fee was last increased in 2003. And finally, the lead-based paint program fees increases other funds by $147,000 overall. Two things going on here. And when we had the public hearing, there was a little confusion, so I wanted to be explicit. One of the fees is simply one set of fees is restructured. So the certification fees paid by firms and individuals performing lead-based paint activities goes from an annual fee to a three-year fee. So if the old fee was $50, now it's $150, but only paid every 3 years. That has a very small revenue impact just because of the timing of the fees, about $7,600 in the 15-17 biennium. The second part of this is actually a fee increase. It increases the fee charged for each student obtaining certification through accredited training providers. So it's paid for each student that gets training, and each student certificate is good for 5 years. So essentially, the fee's paid once every 5 years for each student. And the fee's going from $17 up to $50 and will generate about $140,000 of limitation or revenues and limitation. And that fee was last increased in 2010. Okay, going on to line 24, it says TURA forecast. That's the tobacco use reduction account. This is the tobacco tax that's dedicated to the program in public health that we call Tobacco Education and Prevention Program. That forecast went up $494,000. That will provide that program with a total of $15.6 million of tobacco tax revenues for the 15-17 biennium. Line 25 shows the technical adjustment, which is primarily the care assist transfer from MAP. And then finally, 26 is the adjustment for attorney general fees that we've been seeing. And that's it.
Questions? Discussion?
Just a quick move. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Linda, on the lead paint stuff, the fees go up for certification and instruction, et cetera. I had heard from a couple of constituents of mine that they had heard that the federal government might be taking over this program. So if that should happen, and I don't know if you've heard that or not, hopefully not, because apparently their fines are a lot heavier than ours.
Oh.
But if that happens, these kind of long-term things where you'd say these guys have paid the state for a three-year and a five-year, what happens to that? Would the feds then impose their own fees on that? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. Thank you. Just occurred to me.
I can get back to you on that.
Okay. If you find out, let me
know.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a quick discussion item. I think this is a great budget, and I really want to thank the co-chairs for listening to the very compelling testimony we had on the tobacco prevention and the C-Care. Thank you for restoring that.
Thank you. Further discussion. Do we need to do the KPMs, or do we want them separately?
We'll do them at the end.
Okay.
Are you ready for a motion?
I am.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO preliminary budget recommendations to Senate Bill 5526.
We have a recommendation that we move the LFO preliminary budget recommendation to Senate Bill 5526. Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. We're still in work session.
We close that work session and we have to
be able to help. Let me ask a question. Okay. So we'll close the work session on public health, Senate Bill 5526, and open a work session on Senate Bill 5527, the public health fee ratification bill. Linda.
Okay, this is the fee ratification bill for a number of those fees. A couple of those fees we just heard about in public health. These fees were administratively adopted, and by law, they must be officially ratified before this session ends, or they go away, basically. So like you heard, they were the two fees were the radioactive materials licensing and the SCID screening panel, and in total generate about $1.4 million, and the expenditure limitation we saw in that package 408 in the budget.
Ready for a motion?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 5527 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
It has been moved that Senate Bill 5527 be moved to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Questions? Pretty easy this morning, folks. So moved. And we'll need carriers here.
It's Thursday.
I'm sorry, what?
It's Thursday.
Yeah, I know. I'm slightly behind here. So we need carriers. On the fee bill, it's a Senate bill. Does the House want to carry it? Do you want to carry it?
I don't care. Whatever you want.
How about you take it in the sub? And if you'd be kind enough, I'll take it to the floor if you'd like.
Sure. Whatever you prefer.
And we'll go there. Okay? House?
Are you going to do the House? Anybody else want to do it? I'm happy to do it.
Okay. We're always nervous about fee bills, so we'll take it.
Mr. Chair, I will note that Senate Bill 228, the fee cap bill, and this fee ratification bill, we will hold, and it will go to full with the budget. So it won't be until we complete OHA, so that the whole package is there.
So we'll close a work session of 5527. I believe we've completed our work sessions for this morning.
Yep.
I'm open to public hearing on House Bill 2618.
Do you have the list? I'll grab it.
Ms. Byers, you want to lead us through this?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, today you have before you a public hearing on House Bill 2618, which expands PERS, police and fire benefits to the employees that work at the stabilization and crisis units of the Department of Human Services.
And, excuse me, I'm losing my voice this morning. We have a panel of people who would like to speak to us.
It appears.
So I'm going to ask them up, and there's only four. Yeah, so if all four can come up at the same time and kind of squeeze together, that might work.
And if I may, while they're coming out, Mr. Chair, there is a Dash A2 amendment that's out in OLIS now. We didn't have that out there earlier, and it, I believe, tries to clarify the relationship between the employees at the SACUs and the clients of those houses.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I ask you to individually, as we take your testimony, to identify yourself to the committee and for the record. You normally have a 3-minute warning that is a dead chicken up here that goes off. You've probably seen this before. But because there's only four of you, unless you really get carried away out, the chicken will not arise from the dead, okay? But if someone goes over about 5 or 10 minutes, the chicken will come up. Okay?
Senator Bates, Representative Nathanson, and members of the committee, I assure you we will not have the chicken arise. It would be brief because this is a compelling issue. Doesn't take a lot of discussion. My name is Ken Allen. I'm the director of AFSCME Council 75. I've been the director for 20 years, and I've known many of you for that long. It's my honor to represent this group of workers. I've represented state workers in Oregon since 1977, and I've represented a multitude of workers that work in the institutions, Oregon State Hospital, Damish, McLaren, Hillcrest, the workers in the Department of Corrections. These jobs are some of the toughest jobs in state government. And it's because of the nature of the clients that they work with. I was the director of the union when Fairview Training Center was closed, and we set up this state-operated group home system. And in those some 16 or 17 years, the nature of the clients has really dramatically changed that are in the group homes. When Fairview closed, the private operators took most of the clients that were healthier, higher functioning clients, and less of the security risks. And a lot of the clients that went to the state operated group homes at that time were medically fragile. They were clients that those private operators couldn't take care of in the communities, and so they ended up in our state-operated facilities. Today, that has changed to where a majority of the clients come from the jail system or public, you know, from the court system into the state-operated group homes. They are clients with severe mental illness, and they're developmentally disabled. For the employees, they are unpredictable in what's going to happen in even in the next hour. And so our members have to be vigilant and on, total alert awareness all the time. And this leads to more incidents against other clients and against staff. And so these are the toughest jobs in state government. The toughest jobs in state government that I've seen in my 38 years of representing state workers. I think, from my estimation of looking back over those 38 years and dealing with all of the employees that do have the benefit of early retirement through the PNF, these are the most deserving group of employees that I've ever met and worked with. So I would ask you to take this very seriously. It's a group of folks that deserve this benefit, and I'm going to turn it over to the rest of my team, but I would be happy to take any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Co-chairs and representatives of the committee, I'd like to thank you, too, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Randy Ritterbush. I am the council representative that represents this group directly. I've had the privilege of doing that for about a year and a half, and I've had the opportunity to bother most of you, and I'd like to thank you for that time, too. Behind me sits a lot of my members that have also bothered you, and they'd like to thank you, too, for the time. As Ken pointed out, the clients have changed over the years, and that's why we're here today and not 10 years ago. We have seen a large increase of the mentally ill portion of the client's disease being more and more prevalent and less of the developmentally disabled part, which makes these clients not only more volatile, but they plan things different. These folks now grew up in homes. They grew up nurtured. Thankfully, they weren't stuck in institutions, but it's made them different. They have a lot of street smarts. They plan their events. They're not responsible for it. It's not their fault. These are wonderful people that deserve our care. All of my members want to do what's best for them. They put themselves at risk every day because you don't treat these people like you would treat a criminal, because they're not. They're wonderful individuals that have needs that a very special group of people are able to take care of. These folks are all in crisis. Their needs are extreme. When somebody hits you in the face, you don't react. You take it. You help the person through it. You calm them down. And tomorrow you take them to the movies. That's not what people do in society normally. It takes a very, very courageous person to do this job. They go to work every day not knowing if they're going to be in the hospital the next day. It has a dramatic effect on their mental health, their physical health, and their lives past their careers. Doing this job for 25 years takes a huge toll on you. That last 5 years probably reduces your life expectancy. I don't want to guess. I don't want to put that number out there. But I've seen it in their faces, and I've watched it. And as Ken has pointed out, these are the most deserving people I've ever met. I personally worked in a prison system here in the state for 10 years. I represented the folks at the state hospital for 7 years. I have never seen anything like this. We owe it to the folks that work with these people, and we owe it to the clients to make sure that they have capable people with the mental capacity to take it, to do the jobs the way it takes. Excuse me, I didn't say that right. But to be able to do the jobs the way it takes to do the jobs, and to be patient enough with these people and have the physical capabilities to help them through their events without hurting them, and to do it in a kind and caring way. And with that, I believe Eva's.
Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Eva Ripito, and I'm one of the political coordinators at AFSCME Council 75. As you heard from Ken and Randy, you've already heard why we think it's important. So I'd like to focus on what the bill does and why we would like to ask for the A2 amendments. The bill has been written to be prospective, so employees only begin to earn police and fire credit from the bill's effective date. Meaning that those who choose to retire immediately will not receive any extra PERS benefits, making a little impact on the 15-17 budget. Police and fire PERS is the only tier for an early retirement, and this is the only way to offer employees the ability for that early retirement with the slightly enhanced final formula benefits in the PNF classification. This leads me to why we believe a stabilization and crisis unit employees should be allowed PNF PERS and the reasons for the A2 amendments. This bill is not an attempt to reclassify the work of the employees of the stabilization and crisis unit as guards or police. They provide behavior supports and are responsible for the health and safety of the clients. In 1994, the Oregon Court of Appeals deemed the work of state-operated group homes as the equivalent to guards at a mental health hospital, and as a result of that, prohibited the employees from being able to strike, just like other job classifications in the police and fire PERS. While calling SACU employees guards is certainly an outdated term for the work that they do, they are responsible for the health and safety of their clients and their care. And as you heard, this care can be physically and emotionally demanding and sometimes lead to injuries that need medical attention and counseling. As we all know, as we age, it becomes more difficult to recover from injuries, even small ones. And it is for these reasons that we believe that stabilization and crisis unit employees are eligible for the PNF PERS benefits. During the hearings for House Bill 2618 in the Business and Labor Committee, advocates expressed concerns over the language used to define the work of the SACU employees. The language described the duties as maintaining the safety, behavior, and control of residents was hurtful to the DD community, and it is important to fix this. The A-2 amendments were drafted to remove references to controlling behavior and make it clear that we are not trying to reclassify the work that SACU does. We worked with Senator Gelser to craft that language that would be define the employees in a clear manner but not be hurtful. I believe those amendments, that you have those amendments now. So thank you again for your time and consideration, and we ask that you please adopt the A-2 amendments and pass HB 2618. Thanks.
Yes. Senator Winters.
I just have one question because I'm kind of, this has been one that I've closely been involved with, what occurs when I state ops and others for years, and that is, and I understand that it is, you are becoming more and more encountered with the violence and actually assaults that happen within the facilities. Can you kind of help and provide us what has been the injury rates of staff? Randy?
Yeah, well, we're on pace to hit about 290 this year. And that's not just injuries that happen every day. Those are ones that require medical attention. 2 weeks ago, we had a person's ear bit almost all the way through. Late last month, we had a client that was in a courtroom that threatened to kill the judge our members dealt with before the police did in a very, very appropriate way, using OICE, which is the methods that these folks have been trained on, kept the person from being tasered. The individual eventually got handcuffed and taken to the hospital, where he was given meds that he put in his pocket and took back to the house, stole a pin, and before he left the hospital, stabbed himself 20 times because the staff were sent away. For the nurses and the doctors to take care of. Unfortunately, they weren't trained on how to deal with the individual. Those are the things that we deal with every day.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So in addition, are you also having an acceleration of individuals where on the private sector that those you act as the safety net when those placements fail? Am I not correct?
That's
yes,
very
y'all the
head nodding. Back there.
That's very true, Senator Winters. As most of you know, the name of the program was changed recently from the Stabilization and Crisis Unit to the Stabilization and Crisis Unit from SOCP, which was this, I can't even remember. State Operated Community Programs. With that change has come a completely different mindset. The clients don't live there anymore. They're there for theoretically a short period of time to get stabilized and moved into the community setting. Several of those of our clients probably that will never happen for, but that is the new model for the program.
Thank you.
Chair. Start there and come this way.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Bates. I can relate to this. I've worked in DD. I've worked in residential treatment. I was a trainer for OIS, mm-hmm. and I helped develop restraint methods, but primarily taking the DD ones and using them on youth in residential treatment. I can relate to the injuries. I've had concussions that had me were so bad that I was thrown up and ended up hospitalized, broken teeth, black eye. I mean, so the stuff here, I really can relate to all this. That being said, I'm concerned with, before I say my concerns, I believe that these employees should be paid more for the work they do and should have good retirement plans. I firmly believe that. I'm new to PERS, and it's a scary topic to me. And so, but on surface level, I have concerns with doing it this way. And the reason is Senator Winters just touched on it, and maybe you can clarify for me. Because when I think of police officers, I think of a certain segment of our population that we've elevated and given special privileges to. And I'm not saying that this group shouldn't have some amazing retirement privileges and so forth. And so to pull out just one subset, one group, what about the nonprofit and the private sector that also, you know, whether it's youth residential treatment and they go through this, what about all the other groups that would come in and say, we go through similar or the same things? So maybe you can answer for me, what about those groups? And are there other groups that have been classified, you know, that wouldn't normally in everyday life be classified as a police officer, but for the purposes of retirement, we have classified them for it? It was just a new concept.
Representative Stark and members of the committee, that's a good question, and I appreciate your background because I can tell that your background gives you the knowledge to ask that. The nature of the number of incidents for this group is much, much higher than anywhere else in state government. And the theory about early retirement for public safety folks is that they shouldn't have to continue to do this work when they get into their late 50s or early 60s, right? It's too much to ask of people. And I think you have walked in their shoes, but if you walked in the shoes of these folks in the settings that they work, mm-hmm. you wouldn't ask that they work until they're 58 or 60 or 62. You'd say these folks have spent 20 or 25 years in this very, very tough situation where every day they may face an injury, and you'd say they are deserving. And our corrections officers, I've met with them and talked to them about the state-operated program, and our corrections officers will tell you that they wouldn't work in this situation, and it's far more dangerous than the situations that they work in. So I hope that answers the question. Are there other groups? You know, I suspect there's other groups. Certainly at the state hospital is a very, very challenging place to work, both for the psychiatric security aides that SEIU represents and the nurses and doctors that we represent. But the extent of it as a challenging workplace is not as high as this program.
May I follow up? Thank you, Chair. And it might be that someone up here with more PERS expertise could answer this as well. Why, just terminology-wise, why write the bill so that it says this group is considered police officers as opposed to saying PERS would include police officers, firefighters, and this group?
Well, Representative Starks, I'll take a shot at it. It's the only mechanism we have for the early retirement, first of all, as Eva has said. There are multitudes of groups that are very deserving, including, at one point, the legislature in the PERS, police and fire. So if you look at everybody that was qualified, that has been put in under this, you'll find that they're not all police officers by any stretch. There are several groups that... You know, the whole reason we have a police and fire retirement is because it affects people's lives and they don't live as long. And this group definitely fits that classification.
There was one other question I had first. We'll come back to. There was going to walk right down.
So okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Skip Olson.
Well, thank you for your testimony, and I really appreciate your background. Mm-hmm. I do think that the kind of work that you do is very similar to police officers. I was very impacted. I still remember the date because something else happened that same day, October 9th, 2013, when I went through a workshop where you actually put us in chokeholds and had the kind of experiences that you experience every day. And I want to make a couple of points about that. One is I remember, this builds on what you were just saying, that you were saying when people are really out of control and the police come and put them in handcuffs and find out that you don't even have basic tools that can help you manage situations like that. The other point I want to make is that it's not just for employee protection, but you serve every day, as the police do, to protect the other people that are living in that situation. So it's not just about protecting employees, it's about protecting the other people who are the public, who are the most vulnerable in our society. And for that reason, I'm very supportive of this. I do hope that we go on and look at other investments we can make in the system, both policy, you know, another tier between the Oregon State Hospital and the SACU as it was originally designed. There is a tier of the really hardest to handle, and I'm very committed to trying to work at finding out what additional tools, you know, should we be owning some of the state property instead of renting it, because you're putting enormous, and I've visited several in my district, you're putting enormous amount of resources into building facilities with padded walls and things like that for the one or two people in those facilities that need that, and I really believe that you should be having more of those people concentrated in state-owned properties where we make the investment, and we'll, because we know we're going to need this for a long time to come. So there's a lot of other areas for improvement, and thank you for working on it.
Thank you. Representative Guy and members of the committee, let me assure you, we have not recommended to put all legislators in chokeholds.
I got out of mine, right? Yeah, he's the one that put me in it.
Senator Olson.
Senator.
Ooh, Senator. Representative Olson.
I didn't have anything.
Yes.
Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to have a little history here to express how long I have heard about this and known about this and all the different permutations it's taken. And I've known Ralph a long time, Ralph Groner, since 89, I think. But I've known Ken longer. And when I was at the county commission, and he's been at this a long time, the job of what he's doing now is what I mean. But I think the gentleman on the left side with the dark glasses, I think I met him before. When I was on House Human Services Committee, they came in, and I think you were maybe in corrections at the time, I'm not sure. But anyway, describing a similar situation and what these guys go through every day. And I used to think that the hardest job and would be being a home care worker and taking care of someone who's completely dependent on their care worker all the time, and that you can never take a break. You're just there, you know, if they need you. And I've always had a lot of respect for people, and I also had a lot of respect for a lot of the people who came through our offices doing that job who were clearly in their 60s, you know, and up. And I don't know how long all of you people back there have worked in this sector, but I imagine it's a while, and you have my utmost respect and compassion, because it's got to be hard. It's got to be hard when you get, and we do, I don't know about the rest of you, but every once in a while I'll be in the grocery or something, and someone will come up and start saying, "You people doing this down in Salem, you people this," and that's just verbal, and, you know, you take it or not, you walk away. But you are really, really doing the Lord's work. I know that you put these T-shirts on and to try to stuff your wings back down, but I can see the bulges and the little halos. And thank you so much for all you do. Really, I mean it. So you can tell I support this, too.
I think she might be, yes.
She needs new glasses.
It's a little squishy, but... What's your name, sir?
I didn't have a comment.
Representative Steyer-Haywood?
Well,
Senator,
then we just went
sides of the dais, Representative Olson.
Yeah, Benadryl.
I just actually wanted to follow up briefly on Representative Stark's question. Representative Stark, if you look at ORS 238.005, that's where it defines who's called a quote-unquote police officer for these purposes of retirement, and that's what this bill references. And most of the people under there, I think we would agree, are in pretty high-stress, high-risk occupations. But of note, liquor enforcement inspectors are also considered police officers for this. And I got to say, I'm sure they run into some trouble. But holy mackerel, I don't think it's anything compared to what these folks do. And I recognize that there's a challenge in thinking about the work that you all do as being enforcement, because I don't see it that way and you don't see it that way. But at the moment, that's the statute that we have that lets us give folks like you for the work that you do. And I could not agree with Representative Boone more. Senator Bates and I had the opportunity to visit one of these places just a few weeks ago and really taken by what we saw there and really understood the situation even better. So I just wanted to follow up on Representative Stark's point and explain that we just don't have much of a choice if we're going to give folks who do this really important work this benefit. That's where we have to put it, and there are other people in that statute who, frankly, I think are at much lower risk than the folks who provide this critical service for our communities.
You might want to put legislators back in it after your experience this session.
Oh, yeah, I would totally like to put legislators back in it because, well, not for me, but for my kids, for crying out loud.
Senator Winters.
Thank you. I'm not going to belabor the comment, and I'm not going to date myself. But along with this issue, there are other issues that I think this body needs to actually pay attention to. You know, they talked about the issue of violence and the changing population, which is true. And I've been talking to Ralph and Eva about staffing patterns and what have you. You know, when we look at, and that's why I asked the question about the incidence of injuries and what have you, and do those comparisons with some of the changes that we've made at the state hospital, I think, you know, we have put individuals at substantial risk. And we also, because unlike the state hospital, in the community group homes, you also have the other piece that we haven't talked about, and that's your general community that's out there. So when things break down and things get bad, that they have to try to control. So they're controlling not only what happens inside. Am I not telling it right?
Yes, ma'am.
You're also controlling what happens outside. And so you are, in a lot of respect, keeping control both inside as well as out. I think sometimes we don't understand all the ramifications that's going on in this particular program. And I've been kind of attached in one way or the other since coming back into this building in 99. I have refused on this dais to turn this over to private. And I will continue to do so. I think it takes a special kind of workforce and everything to do the work that they're doing. It is not just like what we see at our, quote, private homes. And I just need to put that on record because I know somebody's going to call me and ask the same question that they've asked me every year, Randy. And I still will say, no, it is special what you do. And it takes a lot of fortitude to do what you do. And the burnout rate has to be very, very high.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
Senator Bates and members of the committee, I just want to thank this committee because I can tell that you're looking at this proactively, and we ought not be penny wise and pound foolish on this. And when Fairview Training Center was still open, I am going to date myself because I have worked with a lot of you for a long time, and I appreciate it. But when Fairview Training Center was still open, we didn't respond with adequate staffing until the safe bills for injuries were so out of whack that everybody then said we have a crisis. But that was a couple years too late, right? We need to look at this now and deal with it before it becomes such a crisis that your safe bills are spending way more money than you want to.
I'll take the. I'm sorry, Senator.
I was just going to follow up with what Ken's. I think you guys were actually at the top of the Dirty Dozen list.
Yes, sir.
Let's say at that time, if I remember. So.
That's a good memory.
Yeah. Before we close down, I'm going to take the chair's prerogative and just tell you a little story and then try to sum up what we've heard here today.
Sure.
Oh, I have one more to come up. Leslie Sutton, I'm sorry. Also, I'm up anyway, but I'll have one more person to speak. Okay. Would you like to come up?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I guess, thank you. I would have.
Thank you, Chair Bates, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Sutton, and I represent the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. We're a group of about 30 organizations that work to promote quality services and community integration for people with developmental disabilities and their families in Oregon. Our membership includes support services brokerages. It includes DD providers, provider associations, members of the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition, which I know you've heard a lot from this session. And we understand that House Bill 2618 truly addresses benefits for workers who provide residential care for people with IDD. This is hard and important work. You have heard about it. You know about it. This is incredible work that people do. We rely on these workers to do a critical job of supporting people with IDD to achieve their goals and be members of their community. And this is what makes a real life. This is what we believe in. But we also believe that all workers deserve adequate compensation, and we believe that this group of workers should get enhanced retirement benefits. But we have very strong concerns with calling them police officers in order to get there. Words matter, and you've heard that over and over again. And in this case, words matter because it talks about how we perceive people with disabilities. Classifying them workers as police officers, even for retirement benefits, doesn't fit the duties of these individuals. And it also doesn't have similar characteristics to the other occupations that are listed, as Senator Steiner Hayward did mention in the bill. It's on page 3 if you'd like a list of the other classifications under this as police officers. The occupations listed are all enforcement occupations. They include parole officers, correctional officers, livestock police officers, liquor control enforcement, airport police. And again, we're looking at enforcers, and the SACU employees are not enforcers. You've heard from them as well. They're there to support people. They provide supervision, training, and care for people with developmental disabilities under Oregon statute. Again, this is not an enforcement occupation. The bill doesn't fit the intellectual and developmental disability system values, which really honor dignity and self-determination of people with IDD, because it equates caring for people with disabilities with caring for people who have committed crimes. And you heard from people earlier today that that is not the work they do. This is not the direction of federal policy. It's not the direction of Oregon policy either. And Oregonians shouldn't have their government saying that their care is similar to those of people who have committed crimes, even for retirement purposes. We truly appreciate the amendment clarification. We really do appreciate that. But it just doesn't go as far as we'd like because it's still calling these workers police officers. And we do propose amending the statute to create a separate classification for these workers that would also allow them to get these enhanced benefits. For instance, you can add a definition to ORS 238005 that would say, you know, DHS Stabilization and Crisis Unit employees. Or perhaps you start a high-risk category. We've talked a lot about, is this about risk or is this about enforcement? We've heard this is really a high-risk job, so maybe we create a definition about high-risk professions that would require this enhanced retirement benefit. And then you could also add to ORS 238-283, Section 3, that police officers, firefighters, and then this new classification, either DHS SACU employees or high-risk employees, could receive these benefits. And this is truly an important issue, not only for the employees, but for people that they support. And it makes a statement about how Oregon perceives people with IDD. And we owe it to Oregonians with IDD and also the SACU employees to grant them these benefits, but do it in a respectful manner and do it right the first time. Calling SACU employees as police officers right now is not the right direction. It's not what they are, and I believe that we can do better.
Thank you for your testimony.
I just need to add, police officers anymore have a broader hat, and that broader hat now, based on laws that we have passed, particularly looking at the societal change, where you have more individuals that have mental illness and other things that rather than, quote, just to become the enforcer, quote, unquote, they are dealing with behavioral and they are dealing with the more compassionate side of issues. I need to put that on the record because their hat has become a lot broader than the old days of where we just talked about enforcement. Oregon has moved to a place where we're trying to be gentler, kinder with all of our population that resides here. You know, we have DPSST, actually, in fact, part of their training. Their training includes how to address and deal with conflicts and things that exist, particularly the mentally ill, and I would suspect the IDD population as well. So I need to put that on record because the enforcement community, their hats are a lot broader than what we know in just crime.
Thank you.
And I need to go.
Senator Winters is known for speaking the truth and leaving immediately. just to sum up, I think you've heard a pretty positive testimony here from the committee on this issue. I think the issue you're raising probably needs to be looked at in a broader sense in our next full session. It's not just for the SACU workers, it's for people at other institutions also who are facing similar risks at their jobs. And I would like to see some definitions around that that are stated in a different way. And I would include policemen and firemen that way, too. I'll give you two quick stories. I'll get you out of here. Driving home last weekend at about 65 miles an hour, maybe a bit more.
Did you meet a compassionate police officer?
I did.
It was his confession, too.
But he wasn't helping me. It was extremely heavy traffic. Car had a flat tire. The state police officer was on his hands and knees in 90-degree weather, changing that tire for a woman. They are not just enforcers anymore. The other story is one that occurred this winter in my area. An extremely violent, autistic young man in his 80s who was violent to himself and others was locked in a padded cell at one of our hospitals for 2.5 months because they couldn't control his behaviors and couldn't find a place to place him in the SACUs because you were all full. It's inhumane what he went through. We know that, and the hospital felt as bad about it as anybody did. They had no other way of dealing with this. They would feed him twice to three times a day when he wanted to eat. Two or three people had to go in the room at the same time. They had to protect themselves against him and keep him from harming himself as much as they could. And the cost of that is about $10,000 a day. So this is not just a human story of what's the right thing to do. It's also one of, when we look at the cost we're talking about here, to balance that against what it's costing us in other parts of the system. Hopefully we're going to be moving towards a system where we don't put our mentally ill people in the prison system. We take them to proper treatment areas, and our mentally ill and our DD people get treated in a much more humane way. And I think we can do that. We can move that path forward. This is a small step. So well, this is just a public hearing today. We'll have more discussion of this bill before this is over with. But we're looking at the financial costs of it and trying to come to an agreement with the co-chairs about how we move this bill forward. Any questions? Any further discussion? Seeing none, thank you all for your testimony, and thank you for the incredible work you people do. I've seen it firsthand, both at SACU, which we visited locally, which I was impressed. The way to get into the office, though, was lifting the garage door. You just do this on a bare minimal budget, and I appreciate the work you're doing. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.